Recorded Books Incorporated presents an unabridged recording of The Body from Different Seasons by Stephen King. Narrated by Frank Muller. This book, copyrighted 1982 by Stephen King, is recorded by arrangement with New American Library Incorporated. This performance is copyrighted 1984 by Recorded Books Incorporated. In Different Seasons, Stephen King has written four novellas, one for each season of the year. This one is subtitled Fall from Innocence. And now, The Body.
One. The most important things are the hardest things to say. They are the things you get ashamed of because words diminish them. Words shrink things that seemed limitless when they were in your head to no more than living size when they're brought out. But it's more than that, isn't it? The most important things lie too close to wherever your secret heart is buried, like landmarks to a treasure your enemies would love to steal away. And you may make revelations that cost you dearly, only to have people look at you in a funny way, not understanding what you said at all, or why you thought it was so important that you almost cried while you were saying it. That's the worst, I think, when the secret stays locked within, not for want of a teller, but for want of an understanding ear. I was 12, going on 13, when I first saw a dead human being. It happened in 1960, a long time ago. Although sometimes it doesn't seem that long to me, especially on the nights I wake up from dreams where the hail falls into his open eyes. Two. We had a treehouse in a big elm which overhung a vacant lot in Castle Rock. There's a moving company on that lot today, and the elm is gone. Progress. It was sort of a social club, although it had no name. There were five, maybe six steady guys and some other wet ends who just hung around. We'd let them come up when there was a card game and we needed some fresh blood. The game was usually blackjack, and we played for pennies, nickel limit. But you got double money on blackjack and five card under, triple money on six card under, although Teddy was the only guy crazy enough to go for that. The sides of the treehouse were planks, scavenged from the shit pile behind Mackey Lumber and Building Supply on Carbine Road. They were splintery and full of knot holes we plugged with either toilet paper or paper towels. The roof was a corrugated tin sheet we hawked from the dump, looking over our shoulders all the time we were hustling it out of there because the dump custodian's dog was supposed to be a real kid-eating monster. We found a screen door out there on the same day. It was fly-proof, but really rusty. I mean, that rust was extreme. No matter what time of day you looked out that screen door, it looked like sunset. Besides playing cards, the club was a good place to go and smoke cigarettes and look at girly books. There were half a dozen battered tin ashtrays that said camels on the bottom, a lot of centerfolds tacked to the splintery walls, 20 or 30 dog-eared packs of bike cards. Teddy got them from his uncle, who ran the Castle Rock stationery shop. When Teddy's uncle asked him one day what kind of cards we played, Teddy said we had cribbage tournaments, and Teddy's uncle thought that was just fine. A set of plastic poker chips and a pile of ancient Master Detective murder magazines to leaf through if there was nothing else shaking. We also built a 12-by-10-inch secret compartment under the floor to hide most of this stuff in on the rare occasions when some kid's father decided it was time to do the We're Really Good Pals routine. When it rained, being in the club was like being inside a Jamaican steel drum. But that summer there had been no rain. It had been the driest and hottest since 1907, or so the newspapers said. And on that Friday preceding the Labor Day weekend and the start of another school year, even the goldenrod in the fields and the ditches beside the back roads looked parched and poorly. Nobody's garden had done doodly squat that year, and the big displays of canning stuff in the Castle Rock red and white were still there, gathering dust. No one had anything to put up that summer except maybe dandelion wine. Teddy and Chris and I were up in the club on that Friday morning, glooming to each other about school being so near, and playing cards and swapping the same old traveling salesman jokes and Frenchman jokes. How do you know when a Frenchman's been in your backyard? Well, your garbage cans are empty and your dog is pregnant. Teddy would try to look offended, but he was the first one to bring in a joke as soon as he heard it, only switching Frenchman to Polack. The elm gave good shade, but we already had our shirts off so we wouldn't sweat them up too bad. We were playing three-penny scat, the dullest card game ever invented, but it was too hot to think about anything more complicated. We'd had a pretty fair scratch ball team until the middle of August, and then a lot of kids just drifted away, too hot. I was down to my ride and building spades. I'd started with 13, gotten an 8 to make 21, and nothing had happened since then. Chris knocked. I took my last draw and got nothing helpful. 29, Chris said, laying down diamonds. 22, Teddy said, looking disgusted. Piss up a rope, I said, and tossed my cards onto the table face down. Gordy's out. Oh, Gordy just bit the bag and stepped out the door, Teddy bugled, and then gave out with his patented Teddy Duchamp laugh. Hee-hee-hee, like a rusty nail being slowly hauled out of a rotten board. Well, he was weird. We all knew it. He was as close to being 13 like the rest of us, but the thick glasses and the hearing aid he wore sometimes made him look like an old man. Kids were always trying to catch smokes off him in the street, but the bulge in his shirt was just his hearing aid battery. In spite of the glasses and the flesh-colored button always screwed into his ear, Teddy couldn't see very well and often misunderstood the things people said to him. In baseball, you had to have him play the fences, way beyond Chris in left field and Billy Greer in right. You just hoped no one would hit one that far, because Teddy would go grimly after it, see it or not. Every now and then he got bonked a good one, and once he went out cold when he ran full-tilt boogie into the fence by the treehouse. He lay there on his back, with his eyes showing whites for almost 5 minutes, and I got scared. Then he woke up and walked around with a bloody nose and a huge purple lump rising on his forehead, trying to claim that the ball was foul. His eyesight was just naturally bad, but there was nothing natural about what happened to his ears. Back in those days when it was cool to get your hair cut so that your ears stuck out like a couple of jug handles, Teddy had Castle Rock's first Beatle haircut. 4 years before anyone in America had ever heard of the Beatles. He kept his ears covered because they looked like two lumps of warm wax. One day, when he was 8, Teddy's father got pissed at him for breaking a plate. His mother was working at the shoe factory in South Paris when it happened, and by the time she found out about it, it was all over. Teddy's dad took Teddy over to the big wood stove at the back of the kitchen and shoved the side of Teddy's head down against one of the cast-iron burner plates. He held it down there for about 10 seconds. Then he yanked Teddy up by the hair of the head and did the other side. Then he called the Central Maine General Emergency Unit and told them to come get his boy. Then he hung up the phone, went into the closet, got his 410, and sat down to watch the daytime stories on TV with the shotgun laid across his knees. When Mrs. Burroughs from next door came over to ask if Teddy was all right, she'd heard the screaming, Teddy's dad pointed the shotgun at her. Mrs. Burroughs went out of the Duchamp house at roughly the speed of light, locked herself into her own house, and called the police. When the ambulance came, Mr. Duchamp let the orderlies in and then went out on the back porch to stand guard, while they wheeled Teddy to the old porthole Buick ambulance on a stretcher. Teddy's dad explained to the orderlies that while the fucking brass hats said the area was clear, there were still Kraut snipers everywhere. One of the orderlies asked Teddy's dad if he thought he could hold on. Teddy's dad smiled tightly and told the orderly he'd hold till hell was a Frigidaire dealership if that's what it took. The orderly saluted and Teddy's dad snapped it right back at him. A few minutes after the ambulance left, the state police arrived and relieved Norman Duchamp of duty. He'd been doing odd things like shooting cats and lighting fires in mailboxes for over a year. And after the atrocity he visited upon his son, they had a quick hearing and sent him to Togus, which is a VA hospital. Togus is where you have to go if you're a Section 8. Teddy's dad had stormed the beach at Normandy, and that's just the way Teddy always put it. Teddy was proud of his old man, in spite of what his old man had done to him, and Teddy went with his mom to visit him every week. He was the dumbest guy we hung around with, I guess, and he was crazy. He'd take the craziest chances you can imagine and get away with them. His big thing was what he called truck dodging. He'd run out in front of him on 196, and sometimes they'd miss him by bare inches. God knew how many heart attacks he'd caused, and he'd be laughing while the wind blast from the passing truck rippled his clothes. It scared us because his vision was so lousy, Coke bottle glasses or not. It seemed like only a matter of time before he misjudged one of those trucks. And you had to be careful what you dared him, because Teddy would do anything on a dare. "Gordy's out, hee-hee-hee, screw," I said, and picked up a master detective to read while they played it out. I turned to "He stomped the pretty co-ed to death in a stalled elevator," and got right into it. Teddy picked up his cards, gave them one brief look, and said, "I knock." "You four-eyed pile of shit," Chris cried. "The pile of shit has a thousand eyes," Teddy said gravely, and both Chris and I cracked up. Teddy stared at us with a slight frown, as if wondering what had gotten us laughing. That was another weird thing about the cat. He was always coming out with weird stuff like, "The pile of shit has a thousand eyes." And you can never be sure if he meant it to be funny or if it just happened that way. He'd look at the people who were laughing with that slight frown on his face as if to say, "Oh, Lord, what is it this time?" Teddy had a natural 30, Jack, Queen, and King of Clubs. Chris had only 16 and went down to his ride. Teddy was shuffling the cards in his clumsy way, and I was just getting to the gushy part of the murder story where this deranged sailor from New Orleans was doing the Bristol stomp all over this college girl from Bryn Mawr because he couldn't stand being enclosed in places, when we heard someone coming fast up the ladder nailed to the side of the elm. A fist rapped on the other side of the trap door. "Who goes?" Chris yelled. "Vern!" He sounded excited and out of breath. I went to the trap door and pulled the bolt. The trap door banged up, and Vern Tessio, one of the other regulars, pulled himself into the clubhouse. He was sweating buckets, and his hair, which he usually kept combed in a perfect imitation of his rock and roll idol, Bobby Rydell, was plastered to his bullet head in chunks and strings. "Wow, man," he panted. "Wait till you hear this." "Hear what?" I asked. "Let me get my breath. I ran all the way from my house." "I ran all the way home," Teddy wavered in a dreadful little Anthony falsetto, "just to say I'm sorry." "Fuck your hand, man," Vern said. "Drop dead in a shed, Fred," Teddy returned smartly. "You ran all the way from your place?" Chris asked unbelievingly. "Man, you're crazy." Vern's house was 2 miles down Grand Street. It must be 90 out there. "This is worth it," Vern said. "Holy Jesus, you won't believe this, sincerely." He slapped his sweaty forehead to show us how sincere he was. "Okay, what?" Chris asked. "Can you guys camp out tonight?" Vern was looking at us earnestly, excitedly. His eyes looked like raisins pushed into dark circles of sweat. "I mean, if you tell your folks we're going to tent out in my back field." "Yeah, I guess so," Chris said, picking up his new hand and looking at it. "But my dad's on a mean streak, drinking, you know." "You've got to, man," Vern said. "Sincerely, you won't believe this. Can you, Gordy?" "Probably." I was able to do most stuff like that. In fact, I'd been like the invisible boy that whole summer. In April, my older brother Dennis had been killed in a Jeep accident. That was at Fort Benning, Georgia, where he was in basic. He and another guy were on their way to the PX, and an army truck hit them, broadside. Dennis was killed instantly, and his passenger had been in a coma ever since. Dennis would have been 22 later that week. I'd already picked out a birthday card for him at Daly's over in Castle Green. I cried when I heard, and I cried more at the funeral, and I couldn't believe that Dennis was gone, that anyone that used to knuckle my head or scare me with a rubber spider until I cried, or give me a kiss when I fell down and scraped both knees bloody and whisper in my ear, "Now stop crying, you baby," that a person who had touched me could be dead. It hurt me, and it scared me that he could be dead. But it seemed to have taken all the heart out of my parents. For me, Dennis was hardly more than an acquaintance. He was 10 years older than me, if you can dig it, and he had his own friends and classmates. We ate at the same table for a lot of years, and sometimes he was my friend and sometimes my tormentor, but mostly he was, you know, just a guy. When he died, he'd been gone for a year, except for a couple of furloughs. We didn't even look alike. It took me a long time after that summer to realize that most of the tears I cried were for my mom and dad. Fat lot of good it did them, or me. "So what are you pissing and moaning about, Verno?" Teddy asked. "I knocked," Chris said. "What?" Teddy screamed, immediately forgetting all about Vern. "You friggin' liar! You ain't got no pat hand! I didn't deal you no pat hand!" Chris smirked. "Make you draw, shit heap." Teddy reached for the top card on the pile of bikes. Chris reached for the Winstons on the ledge behind him. I bent over to pick up my detective magazine. Vern Tessio said, "You guys want to go see a dead body?" Everybody stopped. 3. We'd all heard about it on the radio, of course. The radio, a Philco with a cracked case, which had also been scavenged from the dump, played all the time. We kept it tuned to WLAM in Lewiston, which churned out the super hits and the boss oldies. "What in the World's Come Over You" by Jack Scott, and "This Time" by Troy Shondell, and "King Creole" by Elvis, and "Only the Lonely" by Roy Orbison. When the news came on, we usually switched some mental dial over to mute. The news was a lot of happy horseshit about Kennedy and Nixon and Cui Moy and Matsu and the missile gap and what a shit that Castro was turning out to be after all. But we had all listened to the Ray Brower story a little more closely because he was a kid our age. He was from Chamberlain, a town 40 miles or so east of Castle Rock. 3 days before Vern came busting into the clubhouse after a 2-mile run up Grand Street, Ray Brower had gone out with one of his mother's pots to pick blueberries. When dark came and he still wasn't back, the Browers called the county sheriff and a search started. First just around the kid's house and then spreading to the surrounding towns of Mottin and Durham and Pownall. Everybody got into the act, cops, deputies, game wardens, volunteers. But 3 days later the kid was still missing. You could tell, hearing about it on the radio, that they were never going to find that poor sucker alive. Eventually the search would just peter away into nothing. He might have gotten smothered in a gravel pit slide or drowned in a brook, and 10 years from now some hunter would find his bones. They were already dragging the ponds in Chamberlain and the Mottin Reservoir. Nothing like that could happen in southwestern Maine today. Most of the area has become suburbanized, and the bedroom communities surrounding Portland and Lewiston have spread out like the tentacles of a giant squid. The woods are still there, and they get heavier as you work your way west toward the White Mountains. But these days, if you can keep your head long enough to walk 5 miles in one consistent direction, you're certain to cross 2-lane blacktop. But in 1960, the whole area between Chamberlain and Castle Rock was undeveloped, and there were places that hadn't even been logged since before World War II. In those days, it was still possible to walk into the woods and lose your direction there and die there. 4. Vern Tessio had been under his porch that morning digging. We all understood that right away, but maybe I should take just a minute to explain it to you. Teddy Duchamp was only about half bright, but Vern Tessio would never be spending any of his spare time on College Bowl either. Still, his brother Billy was even dumber, as you will see. But first I have to tell you why Vern was digging under the porch. 4 years ago, when he was 8, Vern buried a quart jar of pennies under the long Tessio front porch. Vern called the dark space under the porch his cave. He was playing a pirate sort of game, and the pennies were buried treasure. Only if you were playing pirate with Vern, you couldn't call it buried treasure, you had to call it booty. So he buried the jar of pennies deep, filled in the hole, and covered the fresh dirt with some of the old leaves that had drifted under there over the years. He drew a treasure map, which he put up in his room with the rest of his junk. He forgot all about it for a month or so. Then, being low on cash for a movie or something, he remembered the pennies and went to get his map. But his mom had been in to clean 2 or 3 times since then and had collected all the old homework papers and candy wrappers and comic magazines and joke books. She burned them in the stove to start the cook fire one morning, and Vern's treasure map went right up the kitchen chimney. Or so he figured it. He tried to find the spot from memory and dug there. No luck. To the right and the left of that spot, still no luck. He gave up for the day, but had tried off and on ever since. 4 years, man, 4 years. Isn't that a pisser? He didn't know whether to laugh or cry. It had gotten to be sort of an obsession with him. The Tessio front porch ran the length of the house, probably 40 feet long and 7 feet wide. He had dug through damn near every inch of that area 2, maybe 3 times, and no pennies. The number of pennies began to grow in his mind. When it first happened, he told Chris and me that there had been maybe $3 worth. A year later, he was up to 5, and just lately he was running around 10, more or less, depending on how broke he was. Every so often, we tried to tell him what was so clear to us, that Billy had known about the jar and dug it up himself. Vern refused to believe it, although he hated Billy like the Arabs hate the Jews and probably would have cheerfully voted the death penalty on his brother for shoplifting if the opportunity had ever presented itself. He also refused to ask Billy point blank. Probably he was afraid Billy would laugh and say, "Course I got him, you stupid pussy, and there were $20 worth of pennies in that jar, and I spent every fucking cent of it." Instead, Vern went out and dug for the pennies whenever the spirit moved him, and whenever Billy wasn't around. He always crawled out from under the porch with his jeans dirty and his hair leafy and his hands empty. We ragged him about it something wicked, and his nickname was Penny, Penny Tessio. I think he came up to the club with his news as quick as he did, not just to get it out, but to show us that some good had finally come of his penny hunt. He had been up that morning before anybody, ate his cornflakes, and was out in the driveway shooting baskets through the old hoop nailed up on the garage. Nothing much to do. No one to play ghost with or anything. And he decided to have another dig for his pennies. He was under the porch when the screen door slammed up above. He froze, not making a sound. If it was his dad, he would crawl out. If it was Billy, he'd stay put until Billy and his J.D. friend Charlie Hogan had taken off. Two pair of footsteps crossed the porch, and then Charlie Hogan himself said in a trembling, crybaby voice, "Jesus Christ, Billy, what are we going to do?" Vern said that just hearing Charlie Hogan talk like that, Charlie, who was one of the toughest kids in town, made him prick up his ears. Charlie, after all, hung out with Ace Merrill and Eyeball Chambers, and if you hung out with cats like that, you had to be tough. "Nothing," Billy said. "That's all we're going to do, nothing." "We gotta do something," Charlie said, and they sat down on the porch close to where Vern was hunkered down. "Didn't you see him?" Vern took a chance and crept a little closer to the steps, practically slavering. At that point he thought that maybe Billy and Charlie had been really drunked up and had run somebody down. Vern was careful not to crackle any of the old leaves as he moved. If the two of them found out he was under the porch and had overheard them, you could have put what was left of him in a kennel ration dog food can. "It's nothing to us," Billy Tessio said. "The kid's dead, so it's nothing to him, neither. Who gives a fuck if they ever find him? I don't." "It was that kid they've been talking about on the radio," Charlie said. "It was, sure as shit, Brocker, Brower, Flowers, whatever his name was. Fucking train must have hit him." "Yeah," Billy said. Sound of a scratched match. Vern saw it flicked into the gravel driveway and then smelled cigarette smoke. "I sure did. And you puked." No words, but Vern sensed emotional waves of shame radiating off Charlie Hogan. "Well, the girls didn't see it," Billy said after a while. "Lucky break." From the sound, he clapped Charlie on the back to buck him up. "They'd blab it from here to Portland. We tore out of there fast, though. You think they knew there was something wrong?" "No," Charlie said. "Marie don't like to go down that back Harlow Road past the cemetery anyway. She's afraid of ghosts." Then again in that scared, crybaby voice, "Jesus, I wish we'd never boosted no car last night, just gone to the show like we was gonna." Charlie and Billy went with a couple of skags named Marie Doherty and Beverly Thomas. You never saw such gross-looking broads outside of a carnival show. Pimples, mustaches, the whole works. Sometimes the four of them, or maybe six or eight of Fuzzy Brackowitz or Ace Merrill went along with their girls, would boost a car from a Lewiston parking lot and go joyriding out into the country with two or three bottles of Wild Irish Rose wine and a six-pack of ginger ale. They'd take the girls parking somewhere in Castleview or Harlow or Shiloh, drink purple Jesuses, and make out. Then they'd dump the car somewhere near home. Cheap thrills in the monkey house, as Chris sometimes said. They'd never been caught at it, but Vern kept hoping. He really dug the idea of visiting Billy on Sundays at the reformatory. "If we told the cops, they'd want to know how we got way the hell out in Harlow," Billy said. "We ain't got no car, neither of us. It's better if we just keep our mouths shut. Then they can't touch us." "We could make anonymous call," Charlie said. "They trace those fucking calls," Billy said ominously. "I seen it on highway patrol. And Dragnet." "Yeah, right," Charlie said miserably. "Jesus, I wish Ace had been with us. We could have told the cops we was in his car." "Well, he wasn't." "Yeah," Charlie said. He sighed. "I guess you're right." A cigarette butt flicked into the driveway. "We had to walk up and take a piss by the tracks, didn't we? Couldn't walk the other way, could we? And I got puke on my new PF Flyers." His voice sank a little. "Fucking kid was laid right out, you know it? Did you see that son of a whore, Billy? I seen him, Billy said, and a second cigarette butt joined the first in the driveway. Let's go see if Ace is up. I want some juice. We gonna tell him? Charlie, we ain't gonna tell nobody. Nobody, never. You dig me? I dig you, Charlie said. Christ Jesus, I wish we never boosted that fucking Dodge. Ah, shut the fuck up and come on. Two pairs of legs clad in tight, wash-faded peg jeans, two pairs of feet in black engineer boots with side buckles came down the steps. Vern froze on his hands and knees. My balls crawled up so high I thought they was trying to get back home, he told us. Sure, his brother would sense him beneath the porch and drag him out and kill him. He and Charlie Hogan would kick the few brains the good Lord had seen fit to give him right out his jug ears and then stomp him with their engineer boots. But they just kept going, and when Vern was sure they were really gone, he had crawled out from under the porch and ran here. 5. You're really lucky, I said. They would have killed you. Teddy said, I know the back Harlow Road. It comes to a dead end by the river. We used to fish for cossies out there. Chris nodded. There used to be a bridge, but there was a flood a long time ago. Now there's just the train tracks. Could a kid really have gotten all the way from Chamberlain to Harlow? I asked Chris. That's 20 or 30 miles. I think so. He probably happened on the train tracks and followed them the whole way. Maybe he thought they'd take him out, or maybe he thought he could flag down a train if he had to. But that's just a freight run now. G.S. and W.M. up to Derry and Brownsville. And not many of those anymore. He'd had to have walked all the way to Castle Rock to get out. After dark, a train must have finally come along, and El Smacko. Chris drove his right fist down against his left palm, making a flat noise. Teddy, a veteran of many close calls, dodging the pulp trucks on 196, looked vaguely pleased. I felt a little sick, imagining that kid so far away from home, scared to death but doggedly following the GS and WM tracks, probably walking on the ties because of the night noises from the overhanging trees and bushes, maybe even from the culverts underneath the railroad bed. And here comes the train, and maybe the big headlight on the front hypnotized him until it was too late to jump. Or maybe he was just lying there on the tracks in a hunger faint when the train came along. Either way, any way, Chris had the straight of it. El Smacko had been the final result. The kid was dead. So anyway, you want to go see it? Vern asked. He was squirming around like he had to go to the bathroom. He was so excited. We all looked at him for a long second, no one saying anything. Then Chris tossed his cards down and said, Sure, and I bet you anything we get our pictures in the paper. Huh? Vern said. Yeah? Teddy said and grinned his crazy truck-dodging grin. Look, Chris said, leaning across the ratty card table, we can find the body and report it. We'll be on the news. I don't know, Vern said, obviously taken aback. Billy will know where I found out. He'll beat the living shit out of me. No, he won't, I said, because it'll be us guys that find that kid, not Billy and Charlie Hogan in a boosted car. Then they won't have to worry about it anymore. They'll probably pin a medal on you, Penny. Yeah? Vern grinned, showing his bad teeth. It was a dazed sort of grin, as if the thought of Billy being pleased with anything he did had acted on him like a hard shot to the chin. Yeah, you think so? Teddy was grinning, too. Then he frowned and said, Uh-oh. What? Vern asked. He was squirming again, afraid that some really basic objection to the idea had just cropped up in Teddy's mind. Or what passed for Teddy's mind. Our folks, Teddy said. If we find that kid's body over in South Harlow tomorrow, they're going to know we didn't spend the night camping out in Vern's back field. Yeah, Chris said. They'll know we went looking for that kid. No, they won't, I said. I felt funny, both excited and scared, because I knew we could do it and get away with it. The mixture of emotions made me feel heat-sick and headachy. I picked up the bikes to have something to do with my hands and started box-shuffling them. That and how to play cribbage was about all I got for older brother stuff from Dennis. The other kids envied that shuffle, and I guess everyone I knew had asked me to show them how it went. Everyone except Chris. I guess only Chris knew that showing someone would be like giving away a piece of Dennis. And I just didn't have so much of him that I could afford to pass pieces around. I said, We'll just tell him we got bored tending in Vern's field because we've done it so many times before. So we decided to hike up the tracks and have a camp out in the woods. I bet we don't even get hided for it, because everybody will be so excited about what we found. My dad'll hide me anyway, Chris said. He's on a really mean streak this time. He shook his head sullenly. To hell, it's worth a hiding. Okay, Teddy said, getting up. He was still grinning like crazy, ready to break into his high-pitched, cackling laugh at any second. Let's all get together at Vern's house after lunch. What can we tell him about supper? Chris said, you and me and Gordy can say we're eating at Vern's. And I'll tell my mom I'm eating over at Chris's, Vern said. That would work unless there was some emergency we couldn't control or unless any of the parents got together. And neither Vern's folks nor Chris's had a phone. Back then there were a lot of families which still considered a telephone a luxury, especially families of the shirt-tail variety. And none of us came from the upper crust. My dad was retired. Vern's dad worked in the mill and was still driving a 1952 DeSoto. Teddy's mom had a house on Danbury Street, and she took in a boarder whenever she could get one. She didn't have one that summer. The furnished room to let sign had been up in the parlor window since June. And Chris's dad was always on a mean streak, more or less. He was a drunk who got welfare off and on, mostly on, and spent most of his time hanging out in Suki's Tavern with Junior Merrill, Ace Merrill's old man, and a couple of other local rum pots. Chris didn't talk much about his dad, but we all knew he hated him like poison. Chris was marked up every 2 weeks or so, bruises on his cheeks and neck, or one eye swelled up and as colorful as a sunset, and once he came into school with a big clumsy bandage on the back of his head. Other times, he never got to school at all. His mom would call him in sick because he was too lamed up to come in. Chris was smart. Really smart, but he played truant a lot, and Mr. Halliburton, the town truant officer, was always showing up at Chris's house, driving his old black Chevrolet with the No Rider sticker in the corner of the windshield. If Chris was being truant and Bertie, as we called him, always behind his back, of course, caught him, he would haul him back to school and see that Chris got detention for a week. But if Bertie found out that Chris was home because his father had beaten the shit out of him, Bertie just went away and didn't say boo to a cuckoo bird. It never occurred to me to question this set of priorities until about 20 years later. The year before, Chris had been suspended from school for 3 days. A bunch of milk money disappeared when it was Chris's turn to be room monitor and collected. And because he was a Chambers from those no-account Chamberses, he had to take a hike, even though he always swore he never hawked that money. That was the time Mr. Chambers put Chris in the hospital for an overnight stay. When his dad heard Chris was suspended, he broke Chris's nose and his right wrist. Chris came from a bad family, all right, and everybody thought he would turn out bad, including Chris. His brothers had lived up to the town's expectations admirably. Frank, the eldest, ran away from home when he was 17, joined the Navy, and ended up doing a long stretch in Portsmouth for rape and criminal assault. The next eldest, Richard, his right eye was all funny and jittery, which is why everybody called him Eyeball, had dropped out of high school in the 10th grade and chummed around with Charlie and Billy Tessio and their J.D. buddies. I think all that'll work, I told Chris. What about John and Marty? John and Marty Despain were two other members of our regular gang. They're still away, Chris said. They won't be back until Monday. Oh, that's too bad. So, are we set? Vern asked, still squirming. He didn't want the conversation sidetracked, even for a minute. I guess we are, Chris said. Who wants to play some more scat? No one did. We were too excited to play cards. We climbed down from the treehouse, climbed the fence into the vacant lot, and played 3 flies, 6 grounders for a while with Vern's old friction-taped baseball. But that was no fun, either. All we could think about was that kid Brower, hit by a train, and how we were going to see him or what was left of him. Around 10 o'clock, we all drifted away home to fix it with our parents. 6. I got to my house at 11:15, after stopping at the drugstore to check out the paperbacks. I did that every couple of days to see if there were any new John D. McDonald's. I had a quarter and figured if there was, I'd take it along. But there were only the old ones, and I'd read most of those 6 times. When I got home, the car was gone, and I remembered that my mom and some of her hen party friends had gone to Boston to see a concert. A great old concert-goer, my mother. And why not? Her only kid was dead, and she had to do something to take her mind off it. I guess that sounds pretty bitter. And I guess if you'd been there, you'd understand why I felt that way. Dan was out back, passing a fine spray from the hose over his ruined garden. If you couldn't tell it was a lost cause from his glum face, you sure could by looking at the garden itself. The soil was a light, powdery gray. Everything in it was dead, except for the corn, which had never grown so much as a single edible ear. Dad said he'd never known how to water a garden. It had to be Mother Nature or nobody. He'd water too long in one spot and drowned the plants. In the next row, plants were dying of thirst. He could never hit a happy medium, but he didn't talk about it often. He'd lost a son in April and a garden in August, and if he didn't want to talk about either one, I guess that was his privilege. It just bugged me that he'd given up talking about everything else, too. That was taking democracy too fucking far. "Hi, Daddy," I said, standing beside him. I offered him the rollers I'd bought at the drugstore. "Want one?" "Hello, Gordon. No thanks." He kept on flicking the fine spray over the hopeless gray earth. "Be okay if I camp out in Vern Tessio's backfield tonight with some of the guys?" "What guys?" "Vern, Teddy Duchamp, maybe Chris?" I expected him to start right in on Chris, how Chris was bad company, a rotten apple from the bottom of the barrel, a thief and an apprentice juvenile delinquent. But he just sighed and said, "I suppose it's okay." "Great! Thanks!" I turned to go into the house and check out what was on the boob tube when he stopped me with, "Those are the only people you want to be with, aren't they, Gordon?" I looked back at him, braced for an argument. But there was no argument in him that morning. It would have been better if there had been, I think. His shoulders were slumped. His face, pointed toward the dead garden and not toward me, sagged. There was a certain unnatural sparkle in his eyes that might have been tears. "Aw, Dad, they're okay. Of course they are. A thief and two Phoebes, fine company for my son." "Vern Tessio isn't feeble," I said. Teddy was a harder case to argue. 12 years old and still in the fifth grade, my dad said. And that time he slept over. When the Sunday paper came the next morning, he took an hour and a half to read the funny pages. That made me mad, because I didn't think he was being fair. He was judging Vern the way he judged all my friends, from having seen them off and on, mostly going in and out of the house. He was wrong about them. And when he called Chris a thief, I always saw red, because he didn't know anything about Chris. I wanted to tell him that, but if I pissed him off, he'd keep me home. And he wasn't really mad anyway. Not like he got at the supper table sometimes, ranting so loud that nobody wanted to eat. Now he just looked sad and tired and used. He was 63 years old enough to be my grandfather. My mom was 55, no spring chicken either. When she and Dad got married, they tried to start a family right away, and my mom got pregnant and had a miscarriage. She miscarried two more, and the doctor told her she'd never be able to carry a baby to term. I got all this stuff chapter and verse whenever one of them was lecturing me, you understand. They wanted me to think I was a special delivery from God, and I wasn't appreciating my great good fortune in being conceived when my mother was 42 and starting to gray. I wasn't appreciating my great good fortune, and I wasn't appreciating her tremendous pain and sacrifices either. 5 years after the doctor said Mom would never have a baby, she got pregnant with Dennis. She carried him for 8 months, and then he just sort of fell out, all 8 pounds of him. My father used to say that if she had carried Dennis to term, the kid would have weighed 15 pounds. The doctor said, "Well, sometimes nature fools us, but he'll be the only one you'll ever have. Thank God for him and be content." 10 years later, she got pregnant with me. She not only carried me to term, the doctor had to use forceps to yank me out. Did you ever hear of such a fucked up family? I came into the world the child of two geritol chuggers, not to go on and on about it. My only brother was playing league baseball in the kids' park before I even got out of diapers. In the case of my mom and dad, one gift from God had been enough. I won't say they treated me badly, and they sure never beat me, but I was a hell of a big surprise, and I guess when you get into your 40s, you're not as partial to surprises as you were in your 20s. After I was born, Mom got that operation her hen party friends referred to as the Band-Aid. I guess she wanted to make 100% sure that there wouldn't be any more gifts from God. When I got to college, I found out I'd beaten long odds just by not being born retarded. Although I think my dad had his doubts when he saw my friend Vern taking 10 minutes to puzzle out the dialogue in Beetle Bailey. This business about being ignored, I could never really pin it down until I did a book report in high school on this novel called The Invisible Man. When I agreed to do the book for Miss Hardy, I thought it was going to be the science fiction story about the guy in bandages and Foster Grants. Claude Rains played him in the movies. When I found out this was a different story, I tried to give the book back, but Miss Hardy wouldn't let me off the hook. I ended up being real glad. This Invisible Man is about a Negro. Nobody ever notices him at all, unless he fucks up. People look right through him. When he talks, nobody answers. He's like a black ghost. Once I got into it, I ate that book up like it was a John D. MacDonald, because that cat Ralph Ellison was writing about me. At the supper table, it was, "Denny, how many did you strike out?" And, "Denny, who asked you to the Sadie Hopkins dance?" And, "Denny, I want to talk to you man to man about that car we were looking at." I'd say, "Pass the butter." And Dad would say, "Denny, are you sure the army is what you want?" I'd say, "Pass the butter someone, okay?" And Mom would ask Denny if he wanted her to pick him up one of the Pendleton shirts on sale downtown, and I'd end up getting the butter myself. One night, when I was 9, just to see what would happen, I said, "Please pass those goddamn spuds." And my mom said, "Denny, Auntie Grace called today, and she asked after you and Gordon." The night Dennis graduated with honors from Castle Rock High School, I played sick and stayed home. I got Stevie Darabont's oldest brother, Royce, to buy me a bottle of Wild Irish Rose, and I drank half of it and puked in my bed in the middle of the night. In a family situation like that, you're supposed to either hate the older brother or idolize him hopelessly. At least that's what they teach you in college psychology. Bullshit, right? But so far as I can tell, I didn't feel either way about Dennis. We rarely argued and never had a fist fight. That would have been ridiculous. Can you see a 14-year-old boy finding something to beat up his 4-year-old brother about? And our folks were always a little too impressed with him to burden him with the care of his kid brother. So he never resented me, the way some older kids come to resent their sibs. When Denny took me with him somewhere, it was of his own free will, and those were some of the happiest times I can remember. "Hey, LaChance, who the fuck is that?" "My kid brother, and you better watch him out, Davis. He'll beat the crap out of you. Gordy's tough." They gather around me for a moment, huge, impossibly tall, just a moment of interest, like a patch of sun. They are so big, they are so old. "Hey, kid, this wet end really your big brother?" I nod shyly. "He's a real asshole, ain't he, kid?" I nod again, and everybody, Dennis included, roars with laughter. Then Dennis claps his hands together twice briskly and says, "Come on, we're going to have a practice or stand around here like a bunch of pussies?" They run to their positions, already peppering the ball around the infield. "Go sit over there on the bench, Gordy. Be quiet. Don't bother anybody." I go sit over there on the bench. I am good. I feel impossibly small under the sweet summer clouds. I watch my brother pitch. I don't bother anybody. But there weren't many times like that. Sometimes he read me bedtime stories that were better than Mom's. Mom's stories were about the gingerbread man and the three little pigs. Okay stuff. But Dennis's were about stuff like Bluebeard and Jack the Ripper. He also had a version of Billy Goat's Gruff where the troll under the bridge ended up the winner. And, as I have already said, he taught me the game of cribbage and how to do a box shuffle. Not that much, but hey, in his world you take what you can get, am I right? As I grew older, my feelings of love for Dennis were replaced with an almost clinical awe, the kind of awe so-so Christians feel for God, I guess. And when he died, I was mildly shocked and mildly sad, the way I imagine those same so-so Christians must have felt when Time magazine said God was dead. Let me put it this way. I was as sad for Denny's dying as I was when I heard on the radio that Dan Blocker had died. I'd seen them both about as frequently, and Denny never even got any reruns. He was buried in a closed coffin with the American flag on top. They took the flag off the box before they finally stuck it in the ground and folded it, the flag, not the box, into a cocked hat and gave it to my mom. My parents just fell to pieces. 4 months hadn't been long enough to put them back together again. I didn't know if they'd ever be whole again. Mr. and Mrs. Dumpty. Denny's room was in suspended animation just one door down from my room. Suspended animation. Or maybe in a time warp. The Ivy League college pennants were still on the walls, and the senior pictures of the girls he had dated were still tucked into the mirror where he had stood for what seemed like hours at a stretch, combing his hair back into a ducktail like Elvis's. The stack of Trues and Sports Illustrateds remained on his desk, their dates looking more and more antique as time passed. It's the kind of thing you see in sticky sentimental movies. But it wasn't sentimental to me. It was terrible. I didn't go into Dennis's room unless I had to, because I kept expecting that he would be behind the door, or under the bed, or in the closet. Mostly it was the closet that preyed on my mind. And if my mother sent me in to get Denny's postcard album or his shoebox of photographs so she could look at them, I would imagine that door swinging slowly open while I stood rooted to the spot with horror. I would imagine him pallid and bloody in darkness, the side of his head walloped in, a gray-veined cake of blood and brains drying on his shirt. I would imagine his arms coming up, his bloody hands hooking into claws, and he would be croaking, "It should have been you, Gordon. It should have been you."